I'm excited that we get to start another week of our 4.5-year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word by continuing our look at the transition period between the Old and the New Testaments. We've actually come into the New Testament time period now, because some of the people that are characters in the gospel stories are alive in 41 BC, which is where we kind of dropped off last week. Herod the Great is alive. He is a younger man and has not earned the title Great yet, but he is alive and acting. We know for a fact that the prophet Simeon and the prophetess Anna, who greet the infant baby Jesus, are alive at this time, as is the characters of John the Immersion's story. His parents, Zacharias and Elizabeth, are alive and seeing many of these events that we're talking about in person. And we can even say that the grandparents of Mary and Joseph and the parents of Mary and Joseph are going to be alive at this time. And they will be born themselves during some of the years that we will talk about today. So we are depending heavily upon the histories of Josephus in the Antiquities of the Jews and Wars of the Jews. And I always encourage Christians that are interested in Bible history background to have copies of those items at their fingertips. They're certainly available online if you don't want to pay for a hard copy of it. But I will quote from time to time from Josephus. So what we've seen at this point in our story is that Herod's family, his big brother, his father, survived being on the wrong side of the Roman Civil War that broke out after the assassination of Julius Caesar. And it was mostly because they were living in the Middle East that they ended up on the wrong side, because Cassius, one of the assassins, ends up being in control of the Roman legions in the eastern part of the Republic. And so they felt that they had to go along with him. He also took hostages from them in order to make sure that they complied with his directives. But once he and Brutus were dead, the Civil War was over, and Herod was among the high-ranking persons who went to Mark Antony, who was a major general on the winning side, at Ephesus, and paid their respects, and basically paid war reparations voluntarily, a whole bunch of money, and then petitioned that they would be forgiven for their part in supporting the losers in that battle. High Priest Hyrcanus also sent ambassadors to that meeting for pretty much the same reason, because he wanted to show he didn't really intend to be a big supporter of the assassins in this civil war. And so pretty much Mark Antony decides he's going to forgive Herod and his family and Hyrcanus for their role, because he felt that they were basically manipulated and abused by Cassius and Brutus, pretty much like all the Romans of that period that were on the wrong side. However, we saw that people were trying to convince Mark Antony that Phasaelus and Herod were bad for the Jewish people, and that they needed to be removed, and Hyrcanus needed to be the only one left in leadership amongst the Jewish people. And Mark Anthony wasn't having any to do with that. He rejected all such claims that they were troublemakers. And in fact, he turns around and declares that the two of them are now tetrarchs, which literally means ruler of a fourth. In practicality, it was a leadership rank immediately below that of ethnarch, which is ruler of a people group. And so that made them just below Hyrcanus in their rank within the Roman Republic. Then Mark Antony starts threatening to execute or kill those that continue to object to his friends functioning as tetrarchs. And in fact, there was a bit of a riot that we finished with on Friday, where some people were killed and many people were wounded because they were dealt with so severely by Mark Antony and his forces. Herod steps forward, and Hyrcanus along with him, and they pay for the funerals and the medical treatment of those that were impacted by that response from Mark Antony. That brings us now to the year 40 BC. After he spent the winter with Cleopatra the VII, Mark Antony decided that he needed to return back to Rome to deal with some rising tension between himself and the other hero of the Assassin War, Octavian Caesar. We know this man much better by his later name, Augustus. And so once Mark Antony left the Middle East, including Egypt in that definition, the Parthians, and just think Persians when you hear the word Parthians, who were sworn enemies of the Romans, they felt now was their chance to strike a blow against the Roman Republic in the Middle East. So they invaded Syria. And they are giving support and receiving promises of support from Antigonus the Jew, who was the nephew of Hyrcanus, and he was of that family that continues to try to overthrow Hyrcanus and assert control of the Jewish kingdom. He promised the Persians or the Parthians 1,000 talents of silver once he plunders the Jewish regions, and 500 women that he plans on capturing in the taking of Jerusalem, if they just guarantee that once all of that happens, they will support him as the new king of the Jews at Jerusalem. And, very specifically, he wants Herod dead because he sees Herod as a threat. And so they all gladly complied with this and invaded the lands of the Jews in the spring of 40 BC. At Pentecost of that year, remember Pentecost falls at the end of spring and the transition into summer every year. So Hyrcanus, the ethnarch of the Jews, the high priest of the Jews, Phasaelus and Herod, Phasaelus is the bigger brother, the older brother of Herod, they were all together in Jerusalem preparing to defend it against this invasion. Hyrcanus and Phasaelus were duped into leaving the security of the walls of Jerusalem to engage in what was supposed to be a peace conference with the Parthians. Instead, they are seized as prisoners. And an agent of Antigonus was dispatched around that same time to seek out and attempt to poison Herod. That didn't happen. So seeing that there was no hope in holding out against the situation as it's unfolding, Herod and those Jews that are with him in support abandon Jerusalem to the advancing Parthian forces, who immediately plunder it. When Antigonus arrives, Hyrcanus and Phasaelus were turned over to him. And Josephus reports that upon meeting his uncle, Hyrcanus, the high priest and ethnarch of the Jews at that time, Antigonus embraced him in the common Middle Eastern hug, you know, the two-cheek kiss thing, as a means of getting close enough to him to bite off his earlobe. And the reason he did this is because under Jewish law, under the Mosaic Code, high priests must be completely intact bodily. And so by biting off just a small portion of his earlobe, Antigonus rendered his uncle incapable of remaining as high priest as far as the Jewish people were concerned. And then, of course, he declares himself high priest and takes over the ethnarchy or the kingship of the Jewish people. Phasaelus, the big brother of Herod, decides that there's no hope left for him. He does not want to be tortured and maybe reveal secrets and things. And so he begins to bash his own brains out against a nearby stone surface, and apparently was successful because he dies of that trauma. And Herod, hearing about all of this, he abandons Judea. He travels through Arabia, down into Egypt, then grabs a ship, goes across to Rhodes, and catches up with Mark Anthony and reports to him all of these sudden developments among the allies of the Roman Republic. I bring this up again. For over 100 years now, the Jewish people have had a mutual assistance treaty with the Roman Senate, with the Roman Republic. That mutual assistance treaty says anyone who attacks the other person in the treaty is immediately the enemy of everybody in the treaty, and assistance has to be rendered. And so Herod, by talking with Mark Anthony as a representative of the Roman Republic, is asking him to invoke that treaty and provide assistance in kicking out Antigonus and the Parthians and returning control of Judea and Jerusalem back to a legitimate representative of the Jewish people. So in 40 BC, Herod arrives in Rome in the company of Mark Anthony. Herod is now in his early 30s. He goes to the Senate. And remember, one of the other things that Julius Caesar declared was that any time Herod or any high-ranking Jewish person comes to Rome, they have to be immediately introduced to the Senate by the dictator, was the word that was used. So Mark Anthony or Octavian, either one, will be in that role. But they have to be personally introduced into the Senate meeting by those high-ranking persons, and the Senate must act within 10 days upon any request made by this Jewish representative. So Herod makes a request for the Senate to declare war upon the Parthians and Antigonus, and to support his future brother-in-law, that would be Mariamne's brother, Herod's not yet married officially to her, but he's engaged. So he asks them to support his young brother-in-law, he's only about 16 or 17 at this time, to become the new high priest and ethnarch of the Jews, because he's next in line. So Mark Antony and Octavian, they throw their support behind this and appeal to the senators to do something instead of declaring the young Jewish man to be the leader of the Jews. They say it would be better to appoint the battle-hardened Herod as the king of the Jews and let him prosecute the war with the Parthians. And that's what the Senate agrees to. And so that is how, in 40 BC, Herod becomes the official king of the Jews. This is the quote from Antiquities of the Jews, Book 14, Chapter 14. When the Senate was dissolved, Antony and Caesar went out of the Senate house with Herod between them and with the consuls and other magistrates before them in order to offer sacrifices and lay up their decrees in the capital. Let me break into the quote. It was the tradition of the Romans that anytime they made a decree, a bronze plaque of that decree was made and then posted in the public area of the Capitol. Back to the quote. Antony also feasted Herod the first day of his reign, and thus did this man receive the kingdom, having obtained it on the 184th Olympiad, when Caius Domitius Calvinus was consul the second time, and Caius Asinius Pollio the first time. And so that ends the quote, and that's another reason why we can be absolutely positive as to the year in which Herod became king of the Jews, because the consuls list is readily available for our history. So leaving Rome, Herod makes his way back to Judea, back to Jerusalem, and he tries first to peacefully convince the people to surrender the city to him and to eject the Parthian-backed Antigonus in favor of himself, who has the backing of their ally, the Roman Senate. Here's the continuation of the quote in Antiquities 14, this time chapter 15. He gave orders that they should, in the first place, make proclamation about the wall that he came for the good of the people and for the preservation of the city, and not to bear any old grudge at even his most open enemies, but ready to forget the offenses which his greatest adversaries had done him. But Antigonus, by way of reply to what Herod had caused to be proclaimed, and this before the Romans and before Silo also, Silo is a general that's involved, said that they would not do justly if they gave the kingdom to Herod, who was no more than a private man and an Idumean, that is, a half-Jew, whereas they ought to bestow it on one of the royal family as their custom was. Now let me break into the quote here and explain some stuff. When it says here that Herod was a private man, it means that he held no official Jewish title at this time in Jewish circles. He at one time had been the Jewish ruler in Galilee, but that had been in the past. The present was that he had no official status. And so that's one of Antigonus' objections. The other one is he's an Idumean, meaning that his family had converted to Judaism several generations back. And so he did not have full Jewish blood. He was only kind of a proselyte into Judaism. He was only adopted into the nation because of things that happened several generations ago. And so that was another objection. Antigonus is basically saying, you ought to accept me. They ought to accept me. I'm a full-blooded Jew. I am a member of the royal family descended from the high priests and ethnarchs of the past. All right, back into the quote. And it says that for in the case that they at present bear ill will to him and had resolved to deprive him of the kingdom as having received it from the Parthians, yet were there many others of his family that might by their law take it, and these such as had no way offended the Romans, and being of the sacerdotal family, meaning the priestly family, it would be an unworthy thing to put them by. So he does offer a compromise. He says, okay, fine. You don't like the fact that I'm backed by the Parthians? Then make one of my relatives the high priest and ethnarch of the Jews. Perhaps he was thinking about his younger relative that Herod had originally supported for that position, because Antigonus, no doubt, based on past history, would have thought he could easily get rid of him and take the power back later, once the Romans were out of the picture. Because that's really what he's reacting to here. He does not have the wherewithal to fight the Romans. And so he is trying to come up with a plan to avoid that, if at all possible. So they can't take the city of Jerusalem at this time. It's too well defended, too well fortified. And so for the next 3 years, from 40 to 37 BC, Herod spends those years cooperating with the Romans in dislodging the Parthians and their supporters out of Jewish territory. So they're fighting all over the place, in Judea, maybe up into Galilee, over into Perea, to get those Parthians out of here. Now, one of the things that he does during that time is he starts eradicating gangs of criminals, Jewish criminals that were operating out of some of the inaccessible Galilean caves. And we know that he's done this before, that is, take on Jewish gangs up in the north country, and he was very successful about it. So some of these gangs are still causing trouble. The caves are very interesting because you see them all over the place when you're riding around in Galilee, even to this day. And if you get yourself barricaded in one of those, it is very difficult to dislodge the person in that cave without grave harm to themselves. And so that's the problem that Herod runs into. And so we'll finish with this story of how he deals with that gang problem. This is from The Wars of the Jews, Book 1, Chapter 16. But he made an expedition himself against those that lay in the caves. Now these caves were in the precipices of craggy mountains and could not be come at from any side, since they had only some winding pathway, very narrow, by which they got up to them. But the rock that lay on their front had beneath it valleys of a vast depth and of an almost perpendicular declivity, inasmuch that the king was doubtful for a long time what to do, by reason of a kind of impossibility there was of attacking that place. Yet did he at length make use of a contrivance that was subject to the utmost hazard, for he let down the most hardy of his men in chests. Now don't think of a little chest, think of a great big box. If you really want to think about it properly, think of like a window washer's arrangement, where you've got the great big rectangular box that's let down the side of the building. He's made something like that. So he let his hardy men down in chests into the mouths of the dens. Now these men slew the robbers and their families, and when they made resistance, they set in fire among them and burned them. And as Herod was desirous of saving some of them, he made proclamations that they should come out and deliver themselves up to him, but not one of them came willing to him, and of those that were compelled to come, many preferred death to captivity. So he tells his men, you take out these groups, offer them the chance to surrender. If not, kill them. You know, send fire arrows in, throw firebrands into those caves, and smoke them out. And apparently a lot of these gang members preferred to die rather than surrender. There is this one final illustration of that. Here, a certain old man, and the word old here is relative, the guy sounds like he's probably in his 40s or 50s at the most. The father of seven children, whose children, together with their mother, desired him to give them leave to go out upon the assurance and right hand that was offered them. You'll hear that a lot in the stories here. To offer the right hand was a guarantee of your safety, that you were basically going to be allowed to live. Now, you might end up becoming a slave, but you were going to be allowed to live. So the family members want to accept that offer. He ordered every one of them to go out while he stood himself at the mouth's cave and slew that son of his perpetually who went out. Herod was near enough to see this sight, and his bowels of compassion were moved at it. And he stretched out his right hand to the old man and besought him to spare his children. And yet did not he relent at all upon what he said, but over and above reproached Herod on the lowness of his descent, meaning you're just an Idumean, and slew his wife as well as his children. And when he'd thrown their dead bodies down the precipice, he at last threw himself down after them. And so that's the sort of radical mindset that these gang members had that Herod is going to be dealing with. Come back tomorrow, and we will continue this study of the transition time into the Gospels.